Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is October 24th, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Well, it's only a few days away. We're having lunch with Catherine, with subscribers in San Francisco on October 29th. That's next Tuesday. I'll be speaking at the annual Fall Conference for the Real Estate and Appraisal Symposium. We'll be talking about what's next, primary trends in the global financial markets, and the impact on the San Francisco Bay Area real estate. Our theme tonight is the cost of capital. All across the markets, all across the news, what you're watching is the heating up of geopolitical economic warfare as global growth slows down. Interesting little article up on the blog. Let me read to you. The headline is Treasuries Lose Cachet on Lowest Federal Demand Since 01. What it says is America's borrowing costs are on the cusp of exceeding the rest of the world in the first time since 2010 after a political stalemate over public funding. And it goes on to describe the U.S. cost of capital as coming even with the rest of the world with sovereign debt at 1.57%. Yes, the dollar's been coming down. I think it's a temporary situation we have all around the world. Everybody's trying to drive their currency down to attract a lot more business and demand for exports or demand for their goods and services so they can export. But the dollar, as far as I'm concerned, is still very much in the channel. But we did see the dollar fall down at the end of the budget stalemate over the last week. We've seen yields drop a little bit with the dollar. We've seen North American equities continue their march up after the correction during the government shutdown, emerging market equities rising with them, and gold and silver rising. We even have several commentators saying that the bottom is in. I think it's too early to tell, but certainly they put in a couple strong days. We had an employment report come out disappointing in terms of the lack of job creation, again, a sign of global slowdown. John Williams at Shadow Stats indicates that the government says the unemployment rate is 7.2%. Williams says the real unemployment rate is about 23.3%. Unemployment has become an even more important statistic than ever because we now have the Fed determining, they say their policies of whether to taper or not based on whether employment is strong. And this certainly doesn't put us in taper zone. So that may have had something to do with the strong performance by gold and silver and the weakness in the dollar. Speaking of support for the equity markets, we see the SEC vote 5-0 on a preliminary crowdfunding rule. And that's going to be interesting. We have a 90-day comment period. Many of the people interested in using crowdfunders saying it's too complicated, it's too tough, it's going to not be anywhere near as attractive as Reg D or some of the other exemption pathways. Again, we have a special Soleri report. We now have links on crowdfunding up on the left on our blog. So I would encourage you to take a look at it if you're an entrepreneur interested in raising capital. There are, crowdfunding will be the sixth exempted pathway. And again, this one, crowdfunding still may not be right for you. But again, a 90-day comment period. So essentially at the beginning of January, we expect to know what the final policy will be. We converted our transcript on the Soleri report we did on a crowdfunding to a new revised report based on that material, and we'll be publishing that next week. So keep an eye out for that if you haven't listened to that one or read the transcript. It's all about what crowdfunding means to you, and even if you're not an investor or an entrepreneur interested in crowdfunding, I think it has the potential to have a real effect on everyone. So you might want to take a look at that. Immigration reform. We see the president saying he's going to move forward with immigration reform before the end of the year. The political pundits say not a good chance of getting it this year. One of the reasons it dovetails with crowdfunding is there is going to be a real push to grandfather anyone getting a degree or graduate degree in the United States to be given an automatic pathway to residency or to citizenship. We attract an enormous amount of incredible talent from all around the world, and then we proceed to send them home. So if that changes, then we're going to see a lot of the crowdfunding money start to finance a flow of young entrepreneurs from all over the world. And I think that policy is very much designed to dovetail. So keep an eye on immigration reform, because that in combination with the changes in the flow of equity capital could have an impact, a dramatic impact over the next 5 to 10 years. The NSA spying story just won't quit, even though Glenn Greenwald is now gotten bought away to his dream independent journalist platform. I have no idea what the impetus is behind that, but oftentimes when you want to get rid of a story that's really torturing you, the thing you do is you buy the person into the dream that they've always had. I'll never forget when one reporter called me many, many years ago when I was embroiled in litigation with the federal government, and they said, you know, I've decided I'm really going to sit down and tell your story. It's going to take a long time to write, but I've decided to do it. Please ship me all the documents. So I shipped her several boxes of legal documents, and then next week after she had received the documents, she called me back and she said, it's the most amazing thing. I just got an offer from New York to finance a company that I tried to finance last year and had no takers. And just out of the blue, somebody called up and financed the company. So I'm sending all the boxes back and I'm not going to write your story. And I thought, oh, well, here we go again. Anyway, so the idea that Greenwald got that proposal, I find to be very interesting. But the NSA spying story keeps going on. We have Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, calling the American ambassador, calling the American president, and then calling the American ambassador to heel, as she's been advised that the Americans are listening to her phone conversations. That's going to be tough on the dollar. I had Greg Hunter doing USA Watchdog tomorrow send me an article about the Saudis threatening to break relations, diplomatic relations with the U.S. They've turned down the seat on the Security Council at the UN. And he's saying, oh, this is tough on the dollar, dangerous on the dollar. No, what's dangerous on the dollar is if all the countries in the BRIC nations come up with ways of cycling the internet cables and protecting their phone conversations and emails with encryption. And in the great game of economic warfare, we don't get the intelligence we need to absolutely have the lowest cost of capital in the game. So NSA spying, very uncomfortable for the U.S. position and the market share for the Anglo-American alliance. We have the ECB coming out yesterday saying that they're going to start doing tougher bank tests. And we see the European bank shares dropping. You kind of wonder how tough they really want to be. Again, the last thing those countries want to really do is significantly raise their cost of capital. But it's tough on banks week. The Department of Justice is proceeding to claw back major negotiations and agreements with a series of different banks that they've been targeting. JP Morgan Chase, of course, with the largest settlement, but also Bank of America, Citibank, everybody's in the headlines. A little bit of what you're watching is the Sheriff of Nottingham clawing back their share. If you look at those big, or the big New York Fed banks, they're very much tied at the hip with the federal government acting as their depository. The government depends on them to raise capital and issue the debt. So you're talking about a very, a squabble within the family. And with the budget cuts upon us and the pressure on the U.S. government, the banks have enjoyed and channeled enormous amounts of largesse during the financial coup d'etat. And I dare say the federal bureaucracies want a piece back. You always would see tremendous tension at times like this between the companies who basically have equity valuations and profits driven by government subsidy, government contracts. They were referred to as proprietaries. And literally the shareholders thought they owned the company. The management thought they ran the company. But the folks in the bureaucracy and the federal government, both overt and covert, really thought of those companies and the value created as theirs. So you see that kind of tension. And but don't for a minute think that that this means a real parting of the ways, because the big banks have enormous operational responsibilities in terms of the U.S. government. And in that sense, there is no real sovereignty by the government from them. They control their bank accounts. pension reform, more and more stories. Check some of them out on the blog. A very important trial balloon I had. Our blogmaster put it up in a commentary. Alice Manel, a very respected academician with many posts in a variety of institutions related to the financial system and retirement system, floating a new trial balloon, proposing that we move the retirement age on Social Security up to 70. Expect to see that proposed more and more. It's all part of the debasement and the slow burn is moving retirement age out. However, if you look at the unemployment statistics and what is happening with robotics, automation, other things, we're also seeing, you know, the big question is where are they going to get the jobs? Where are these jobs going to come from? So there's a real dance around making, as I said, and as I keep saying, this number of making the legacy systems assets reconciled to the liabilities now that the money's been shifted out on the financial coup d'etat. I put a commentary up on the blog about the politics of sex and race. I was on a wonderful radio show this weekend talking about Obamacare and was shocked to discover that the commentator really did believe that the House Republicans' problem with Obamacare had to do with the president's racial background. I was a little bit shocked, and so I wanted to make a comment about it. It's very important not to fall prey to the divide-and-conquer politics. I know I beat this drum a lot on the Sillery Report, but it's extremely important that we not fall into that. You might want to check out that commentary. Wonderful, wonderful sort of comment from our team on the roundup today. Darlene Heckman, who runs our customer service, said, you know, please remind everybody they don't have to give personal information on the websites when they when you shop around. And there are lots of opportunities to shop around and do it without giving personal information. In fact, if you look at the latest headlines on the all the issues of using a variety, both the government's and private websites on these issues, you want to be very, very careful about your personal information. I mean, I will just tell you, as a former government official who worked a lot with databases and data operations in government, you should assume that no data that you ever, ever give to the government is secure. It's just absolutely not secure. We are beginning to slowly see, you can tell from the comments coming into the blog from Sillery Report subscribers, we're beginning to see a real dawning of people's realization of how uncomfortable and expensive Obamacare is going to be. The one thing I don't think they realize is the extent to which people are going to sign up for insurance, pay their money into the system and think they're covered, and then show up and be run around in all sorts of games about why you're disqualified for this or why they can't do this or whatever. And at this point, you know, I just assume as a practical matter that the whole thing's going to be fraudulent. That's not to say it's not going to work for certain people. There's always exceptions to the rule. But at this point, I would say I'd fundamentally lost faith in the system. Our hero this week is programmer and entrepreneur Patrick McConlogue from New York, who passed a homeless man every day on his way to work and gave him a choice between $100 or a free computer programming lessons, a laptop with solar, this powered with a rechargeable solar source. It's a 23-year-old young man who apparently blogs and has probably made great hay out of this. But the homeless man, Leo, the homeless man chose the free computer programming lessons, and so apparently they're proceeding, and they claim the homeless man has built his first app. And it's just a cute little reminder that we all, if we all just do what we can do, it's amazing what can happen. Ask Catherine some really good questions this week. One person wrote and asked about Karen, I think it's pronounced, it's H-U-D-E-S, Karen Hudes, I think, who is a World Bank whistleblower. I've been asked several times about her before, and each time have said I've looked at her information and don't think her information is that useful. First of all, if you look at when she became a whistleblower, you almost wonder what she was doing for the prior 10 to 15 years and didn't notice there was a problem. If you look at much of what she talks about and or recommends, I think there's much better information about what the World Bank has been up to. And so I haven't seen a need to sort of post much of her stuff. We finally had somebody also post this week on the blog. Let me just read the comment. A few months ago, one of your subscribers asked about Karen Hootie's. Gary Null had her on the Progressive Commentary Hour this week. I think your assessment of her was correct because her information was rather pathetic and she really didn't tell anything typical of your limited hangout. It was an unpleasant interview. Even Gary was frustrated and I think cut her off early since she only repeated herself about how much she was doing as a whistleblower. Good call. So I'm amazed at how often I get asked this question. But I want you to be really, really careful. Whistleblowers, you know, sometimes people will say that I was a whistleblower. That's not the case. I was the target of a whistleblower. So you want to be really careful because just because somebody's a whistleblower does not mean that they are sincere or authentic, or even if they are, and as for all we know this person is, doesn't mean their information is useful for you. So I would just be very careful. Dear Catherine, what happened to all the riots and protests that we saw in Europe and in all the U.S. over the tough economic conditions? Have things really improved that much such that people don't feel the need to protest anymore? Or is something else going on? Good question. I'm going to send that over to some of my contacts in Europe and see what they say. Would you please ask Catherine to comment on this? And the subscriber had sent a link to an interview with Lord Blackheath in London or in England, talking about Foundation X. And he's got several presentations in YouTube, including in the House of Lords, about Foundation X. And here's... And I've run into quote-unquote Foundation X many times over the last 10 years. What happens is somebody comes to you and they say, oh, I represent, or I've been contacted by someone who represents a foundation and they have billions of dollars and they want to now spend it to save the world. And if you will just do this thing and that thing and this thing, and the next thing you know, you know, people are spending their lives running around trying to get ready for the trillions of dollars from Foundation X that never shows up. And, you know, my attitude is every time I'm approached with this, I just roll my eyes and say, well, when you're ready to write a check, call me. And I can't tell you how much money and time I save. It's the same thing with various currency scams like the dinar. And, you know, there's nothing more real than somebody who's willing to take the time or write the check. And so when somebody shows up and says, you know, we want to spend $100 billion to save the world, I say, fine, you know, just write a check for $10,000 and that will provide the time for this person or that person or this thing to talk about it. And, you know, somebody who's got $100 billion, if they won't write a check for $10,000, then don't take them seriously. Anyway, so I don't take Foundation X seriously. Period. Our interview is on the emerging markets with Chuck Gibson. I put the chart up on the blog post. You can see there's been an absolutely remarkable divergence in valuations in the emerging markets and the North American equities this year. So this gets back to what I talked about, the cost of capital and the nature of economic warfare when the U.S. companies are trading at PEs of 24 and 25, and the emerging markets are trading at PEs of 13. That means our companies can go into their markets and buy up market share or buy up companies or buy up talent very, very cheaply. It's a tremendous advantage, and I suspect it's one of the reasons we see G7 targeting the tax havens. They want to see that capital drive their PEs up as opposed to invest in a variety of other things. So Chuck and I talk about what, you know, how exactly that's happened and what it means, both short-term and long-term. Is this an opportunity or something to be concerned about? I think because the developed world is worrying about re-engineering their debt and retirement liabilities, there's going to be tremendous pressure during 2014, 2015. And so with global growth slowing, it may not be that the emerging market stocks for the next couple years reflect their valuations or reflect the valuations that their underlying growth might normally, or you would expect with that kind of underlying growth. But Chuck, as usual, had some great charts, and it's a wonderful framework and overview for the issues at hand. And let's go to the movies. Our movie is Stock Shock. It's the story of the SiriusXM radio and all the shenanigans around the early years of that company. It's fascinating, and it's a reminder of how many things can go wrong. And it begins to lead you into the story of naked short selling, which is one of the problems that beguile smaller companies in a market which is, in my opinion, not properly regulated. Patrick Byrne, the CEO of Overstock, did great work and put up a website on naked short selling. Naked short selling is one of the problems that has tormented mining stocks, and one of the reasons it makes mining stocks, particularly the junior mining stocks, so tricky. But it's a great and sort of chilling tale of reminding you all the things that can go wrong, particularly in the life of a young company. And because of what's starting to happen with more and more companies, startups happening around new technology, and because what crowdfunding may do, I keep trying to warn everybody about all the things that can go wrong with an investment. And Stock Shock is a pretty interesting little documentary. I recommend it to you. Okay, well, that's it for today. I don't do a salary report in the last week of the month, but yes, I'm going to do one because it's Halloween, and I'm finally going to come up with my zombie report. Those of you who have been subscribers know for several years now, I've been trying to figure out what in the world is this zombie thing about, and we have a couple of people on our team who are keen followers of the zombie phenomenon, keep putting me on to the best movies and the best cartoons and the best everything in zombie. We've published several sort of reports on the blog. So finally for Halloween, the Solari Zombie Report. And then the following week, it's our Coming Clean selection. Joseph Farrell, who's now going to be doing a quarterly report with me, will be joining me. We're going to be talking about his two new books and how the reinvestments of the breakaway civilization relate to what's happening in the economy and what that could mean to the economy and the markets going forward. And then, very interesting, given that gold may be turning up, we'll see. November 14th, I'll be joined by Franklin Sanders' Precious Metals Market Report. We look forward to that. So until Halloween with the Zombie Report, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Welcome to the Solari Report. This is our quarterly equity overview with Chuck Gibson. Chuck is a person who needs no introduction on the Solari Report. We've had a great series for the equity overview so far this year. Over the last 12 months, we've talked about the long-term bull market in bonds and when it's going to turn and what that will mean to the equity markets. Chuck did a great piece on market cycles. We went back and looked at the market cycles in the U.S. market and then had a great one on dividends matter. And now we're going to turn to the emerging markets, particularly because the emerging markets behavior this year vis-a-vis the developed markets has been very interesting. And so I'm very pleased we could do this at this time. So, Chuck, welcome to the Solari Report for Emerging Markets 101.
Thank you. It's, as always, great to be here.
Okay, so lead us through your analysis. You've prepared a great analysis with lots of charts. We have 10 charts, which will be up on the blog post, and we're going to integrate them in with the video. So people can also listen to this in video form and watch the charts as we go. So take it away.
Okay, so when we brought this up as a subject, the first thing I thought I needed to do was to come up with a definition of what the emerging markets are.
Good luck.
Yeah, and exactly. Unfortunately, what I found out is that this is easier said than done. The term emerging markets has now been around for almost 25 years and has come to define a wide swath of the world undergoing rapid economic change. Right now, dozens of countries fall under this label, even though they're evolving at their own pace and with their own twists on their economic development. So let me give you a quick little history. The term emerging markets first appeared in the early 90s, and it's now widely acknowledged and used, not just in the financial world. Prior to that, these countries were commonly referred to as either underdeveloped or LDCs, which is lesser developed countries, and the slightly derogatory third world. It's easy to find lists of emerging market countries, but it's hard to find a single agreed upon definition of what they are. The big four emerging markets that originally came out were referred to as the BRICS, which was an acronym that stood for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Since then, that list has expanded. Let's take a look at chart number one, which comes from MSCI. And this is their latest list of who they consider is an emerging market country.
I hate to make it more complicated. I don't know if you saw the headlines yesterday. Somebody's come up with a BRITS. So it's they replaced China with Taiwan, and that's the BRITS.
Okay, well, and that has expanded. It included, you know, it's gone. Everybody uses the acronym now, so
right.
It's interesting. So if you look, there's a huge variety of people on this list. You see China, Chile, South Africa, Hungary, and Mexico, etc. But given the diversity of the economies that you see here, you can see how coming up with one definition to cover that wide range is going to be difficult.
Right. Because subscribers are used to me doing this, I often talk about G20 versus G7 or G8 and the difference that, you know, the 12 or 13 from the 7 or 8 to 20 often picks up a lot of the BRICS. So it's another way of kind of framing who's in the basket.
Okay. All right. Good. So to move on, what we see here is, so I thought that another way to maybe describe what the emerging markets are is just simply all those other countries who are not considered developed.
Right.
Well, you know, developed, when I'm talking about that, I mean the major European countries, plus the United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand. But after thinking about it, I came to the conclusion that that really isn't all that particularly useful, since it doesn't really help narrow down the scope. Because basically every other country in the world would then be considered emerging, and so I thought, forget that idea.
And let me just make one other comment, because the other term I do use with subscribers is frontier markets.
Okay.
So there's the Wild West of the emerging markets,
correct,
if you will, is the frontier markets.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up. I had a chart I was going to bring up, and that was going to give you a little insight as to the frontier markets. I didn't do that because I wanted to keep it as simple as possible, because, once again, there's no clear definition of what a frontier market is, because there are some countries that are, one might consider frontier, some that might consider emerging.
Right.
So we could talk about that on another one.
Okay.
Okay, so rather than looking for a definition, I gave up, and I thought that maybe a more useful way to look at this is to see if there was some common key attribute that all these countries shared. So let's just take a look at some of those. So first off is increasing foreign investment. The emerging markets tend to see strong foreign investment as hot money chases opportunities and growth. So let's take a look at chart number two here. This shows capital inflow into the emerging markets. And just to make sure everybody understands, capital inflow is the amount of private money flowing into a region. So what you can see on this chart is it's a yearly chart, but how much money is on the vertical axis has moved into each of the emerging market regions by year. It's clear to see that, you know, this huge ramp of money flowing into the emerging markets that occurred from 2002 into 2008, and why the emerging markets did so well, the emerging market stocks did so well during that period. But since the 2008-2009 recovery, you can see that the money did come back, but it's basically been flat since then.
Mm-hmm.
So another common theme that you would see is that they're in transition. So these economies are in transition. Emerging markets are often in the process of moving from a closed economy to one more of a more open economy, which creates an immediate opportunity for growth. So let's take a look at growth in chart number three. And what you see here is a chart of global GDP growth by year, split between the developed markets, which are in blue, and the emerging markets are in orange. So there's a lot of swings, which you can see in the absolute value of the growth here. But, you know, that's not what's important here. What you really should be focusing on here is the fact that the size of the emerging markets in orange is expanding, and the size of the developed markets, which are in blue, are shrinking.
Right. It's amazing when you spend time in one of these markets. So which has the strongest growth rate in this chart? So the emerging markets on average have 5 to 6,
mm-hmm.
or 4 to 6%.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to a place where they're the strongest, so in China, when it's above 12%, it's amazing to be in that place, because it just
hustle and bustle and everybody's moving.
It's, if you've ever heard the Grateful Dead song Trucking, everybody's like going to that beat. And it's, you know, whenever somebody in the United States says, I'm really depressed, I say, hey, go, you know, go plop down in the middle of Indonesia. You'll cheer up.
All right. One of the other common themes, of course, is that they have young and growing populations.
Right.
So emerging markets often have younger populations, which are capable of spurring strong economic growth by replenishing aging workers and also consuming goods and services. So if you can see this is reflected in chart number 4, which shows the working age population of the emerging markets, which are in blue, and the developed market, which is in black.
Right.
And you can see it's very clear that from this chart that, you know, where we are today and looking into the projections in the future, that the emerging markets have a huge advantage when it comes to the working age population as compared to the developed markets. So clearly, the more non-working age population a country has, the greater of their GDP is required to support those.
Right.
And rather than actually using that productivity towards economic ventures.
Right.
And Japan is a really good example of that.
Right.
Okay, one other theme that we can see within all the emerging markets is that they have, at some stage in another, is an underdeveloped infrastructure. And I don't have a chart for this, but there's some pretty good information. There's some pretty good facts.
It's very, the way to understand this is you beam down into Zurich, and everything is perfect. And then you beam down into New Delhi, and you see an entire economy trying to race far beyond its roads, its bridges, its tunnels. It's so painful because you see an economy that's full of dynamic growth, and the growth rate could be so much higher if somebody would just sit down and fix the, you know, the postal system. But it doesn't happen, and it's very... There's a huge piece in The Economist when India turned down early this year, huge piece in The Economist basically laying out, you know, sort of the long-term infrastructure needs that India had to attend to if it wanted its stocks to go back up. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I that flashed, you know, funny you brought up New Delhi. I saw, I don't remember what TV show it was, but and I don't watch much TV, but this really stuck with me. It was some people were in India, and what they showed was the electrical lines and the telephone lines are just hanging from buildings everywhere. There's not, you know, the post that we have to hold these things up, and it's just a mass confusion. And how anybody knows where what goes if they need to work on it has got to be, you know, one of the hugest mysteries that there are in New Delhi. So anyway, the emerging markets are often in an early stage of building infrastructure. And while this means there's often pent-up demand for government spending to help spur that growth, the flip side, of course, means that there are higher costs and less efficiencies for businesses until they've actually used or created that infrastructure. And the key long-term driver for infrastructure demand, of course, is urbanization. It's expected that the urban population of the emerging markets will increase by a massive 2.6 billion people from 2010 to 2050. You know, as these people move to cities across the world, the infrastructure companies will need to be able to provide those essential services like water, power, and highways, which act as a foundation for the long-term successful growth.
It's amazing, the urbanization.
And, you know, one other thing is that the governments also understand that infrastructure is critical to the development of their economy. And countries, for example, like China and India, have both budgeted to spend over $1 trillion in their respective 5-year plans going forward to invest in infrastructure.
Right.
All right. One of the other common themes, of course, is growth of consumption. And the emerging market economies historically have tended to focus on producing goods to be shipped abroad to wealthier countries. And while this is great initially because it creates a foundation for their fledgling economy, doing so makes them subject to the vagaries, of course, of the developed world economies.
Right, and that's part of what we've seen over the last year is the Europe, I think, is China's largest customer.
Yes.
Europe went down, you know, sort of the economy slowed down. China got a huge, huge shift in exports and demand.
Yeah, and it's real hard to shift your economy as fast as they needed to because of the fall of Europe. So, you know, this is, of course, as you mentioned, recognized by the emerging markets already, and their models are moving towards this economy that is more dependent upon domestic consumption-led growth rather than exports.
Right.
And so if you look at chart number 5, this shows two pie charts of global consumption. The first pie chart on the left is for the decade of 2000 to 2010. And one on the right is actually the current decade, which projects forward into 2020. In both charts, you know, I'm going to use G7 as a reference there. It's the pie piece that's in yellow, and the rest, and so what it is it breaks up the G7 and the rest of the world, which is split up between the red, which are the BRICS, and the rest of the world, which are in blue.
Right.
So anyway, what you can see from the decade from 2000 to 2010, G7 drove consumption growth with 60% of the total of all demand, whereas in the current decade, it's estimated that that will drop to 28%, which, of course, is, you know, a dramatic halving of the growth.
That's an enormous drop.
In 10 years, it's huge. It's huge. So one real positive thing that, you know, comes to mind is the emerging markets in their position with regards to low debt levels. So, you know, thanks to their robust growth and spending restraint, many of the emerging market governments and their corporations really have healthy balance sheets, you know, healthy as compared to the developed world. In addition, the citizens of the emerging markets tend to also have low debt levels and high savings rates.
Right.
And that also obviously bodes well for future spending.
So they're really financially, in many ways, they're much more financially sound than the developed world.
Correct. Correct. Now, if you take a look at chart number 6, so this is, hopefully I can explain this reasonably simply. So this is simply a snapshot of deficits. On the left side, we have plotted debt as a percentage of GDP. So that's the vertical axis. And on the horizontal axis, we show deficit. That's deficit as a percentage of GDP. So what you really want to take out of this is that the majority of the developed world is centered on the far right-hand corner, upper right-hand corner of this chart. And that's because they have a large deficit and a large percentage of governments, GDP. Whereas the emerging countries are all, of course, bunched in the lower left-hand corner, reflecting much smaller deficits and debts.
Well, there's another way to look at it, though, and that is the developed world is getting goods and services from the emerging markets and giving them crappy paper back.
And sometimes you have to do that to move forward. All right. I got two more for you. So finally, what we have is productivity, and what we know is that the productivity in the emerging markets has greatly lagged that, and it tends to lag it of the mature economies. So better infrastructure and technological advances in the emerging markets will significantly boost productivity, which, of course, is a major factor in a sustainable growth model.
Right.
And one of the productivity advantages that the emerging markets do have, though, is labor. So if you look at chart number 7.
Okay.
And what this shows is labor growth across the world. And the red line, which is the emerging markets, has far outpaced the mature economies, which is, of course, in blue. And that's been going on since the mid-90s. One of the other interesting tales on this chart really is about how while the growth has been spectacular for the emerging markets, it's really topped out in 2006. And what we're starting to see is that it's starting to decline. But it's still two times greater than the growth of the rest of the world. So it's not, they've got a long way
to go. Right, and it's very interesting how you measure productivity because, for example, one of the things we struggle with China, you know, we think of the U.S. system as having fraud problems. You know, when you get Chinese financials, you just never know. It's kind of, it's kind of the Wild West. And so you don't begin to have that infrastructure of regulatory compliance that you do in the developed world, and it makes it much more unnerving to have to deal in those environments. So productivity can be a funny thing. The other thing is, you know, it's a lot easier to implement certain kinds of new technology in a country that's a blank slate.
Whereas absolutely.
Here, where you try and bring something in, you know, you have unions, you have all sorts of issues.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, use telephony as an example. You have the infrastructure of the landlines, which, you know, when you didn't have that in the emerging markets, they can go right to cell phones and they bypassed us in, you know, in no time flat.
Right.
We're trying to live within the infrastructure we have.
Right. So there's leapfrogging going on.
Absolutely. So the last one I have, I think, is actually a fun little chart. It's chart number 8, and which I found, and I think it's from The Economist, which shows the emerging world, or excuse me, the emerging market world share of different things. And so while it's nothing really of major significance, other than I thought that, you know, bringing this here is pretty interesting, it's kind of fun. So just for example, you can see that 85% of the world's population is contained within the emerging markets. 80% of the world's mobile phone subscribers, right, are within the emerging markets.
Right.
They consume 70% of the world's steel consumption, and they're 50% of the world's exports, and 30% of world's consumer spending is all.
Wow.
And the one thing that this chart does, so there's a bunch of other things that are really interesting there, but there's a couple things that I found that I would love to have added to this chart. One of them is that the emerging market consists of 75% of the world's land mass.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, and this is really relevant to investors, is that they only account for 12% of the global equity market capitalization.
Right. Now, here's what I wanted to bring up, because yep. I remember in it was 1991, Richard Breeden, who was the head of the SEC, asked me to be on the Emerging Market Task Force. And it was a task force that the SEC put together to teach all the emerging market countries one by one how to start stock markets. And I'll never forget, in 1997, I was in Shanghai, and Deng had died, and I was coming into a university in Shanghai, and you had 50 people sitting around in the guardhouse listening to this portable radio. And the guy who was with me, it was Chinese, said to me, "What do you think they're listening to?" And I said, "Are they listening to news of Deng's death?" He said, "No, they're listening to the first day of the Shanghai stock market."
Oh, really?
And, you know, the Chinese are such gamblers.
Yes.
I said, this is going to be unbelievable.
Yes.
And what we're looking, you know, we're looking at a period where the last 20 years ago, none of these countries, as a real matter, had real stock markets. And, you know, not to say that they didn't have some companies that weren't publicly traded, but in terms of real markets, they really didn't have financial markets. And what we're watching is an explosion of securitization, both companies and debt, throughout the emerging markets. And what I didn't understand until you did the presentation, I think it was 2 quarters ago, where you showed how few of the global investors are equity investors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is very new, where we're seeing equity markets develop throughout the world, and it still hasn't happened yet. I mean, the sovereign wealth funds, the institutional investors are investing, but the average retail investor really hasn't become an equity investor yet. And what happens if that happens?
Right.
Right.
That could just explode.
Right.
You know, I don't know if people know this, or most people might not know this, is that you cannot invest directly in the China stock market. You can invest in a China ADR within the United States.
Right.
Or the other alternative you have is to invest in Hong Kong, which invests in the China stock market. But the world has yet, they haven't opened up their market for the rest of the world to come in and invest.
Right. If you invest, you have to invest in non-voting shares. Yeah, they're very big on the A share, B share model.
So with that as a backdrop, you know, what we know is that for the last 2 decades, the emerging markets have generated some of the most exciting global economic opportunities. So as economies in Asia and Latin America and, you know, Eastern Europe begin to grow at rates that far outpace the developed countries, and combined with new economic reforms and trade liberalizations, this opened the door to Western investment.
Right.
So in the meantime, Increasing urbanization and the emergent middle class gave rise to a new generation of consumers who had strong demands for goods and services, and of course the infrastructure development is needed to support their lifestyles. So as a result, investors up during this period of time have been able to enjoy a period of exceptional returns.
Right.
So as a growth investor, because that's what, you know, we are, it kind of makes you giddy. Seems like this is a slam dunk for an investment, doesn't it?
Well, except for, you know, it's interesting because you're talking about investment, which is impacted by fundamental cycles, but it's also impacted by currency fluctuation. And if you've ever seen an investor who was really pleased because they had great dividends from emerging market companies, they're getting, you know, great dividends, and suddenly the dollar swings the other way and their dividends, the price of their stock gets cut in half and their dividends get cut in half, it can be a very gut-wrenching experience. So I think, you know, and that's one of the reasons I think since the 2008 scare, a lot of investors are a little bit more nervous about moving back into the emerging markets.
Absolutely. And I think that leads right into what I want to talk about next, which was the risks that are associated. You know, while it sounds really, really good of what this thing provides, you brought up one example of one of the risks. Let's go through, you know, a couple more to see.
The Wild West is not everything. The Wild East is not everything it's cracked up to be.
It might or might not be. Let's let the listeners make that call. So as you brought up, the first important thing, I think, is the currency risk. So anytime you invest in an international market, investors face the risk that the exchange rate will move in an unfavorable direction, right?
Right.
And so, for example, you brought up the stock example where you can get hit on not only the gains that you're seeing, but also in your dividends. But the foreign currency in which you invest in is, you know, denominated, declines in value relative to the dollar, it could reduce your gains and also magnify or potentially even magnify losses.
Right.
That was what you were trying to say. But, right. You know, I think you brought up a point that I really didn't consider during this, which is if you're buying an investment for a dividend and, you know, a lot of people are going to be more patient to be able to have the swings in the price if they can continue to get that dividend. But
right.
If that dividend now becomes, you know, an element that they are no longer as attractive as it was, then people
right.
get nervous and they want to bail out.
Right.
Another risk that we need to consider is inflation. So a mix of strong economic growth and insufficient monetary strength really can result in high inflation, a problem that's regularly cropped up in the emerging markets. And runaway inflation and policymakers' actions can used to combat these things to devalue, you know, what they can do is to devalue their currencies, which can hurt, of course, corporate profit margins and abruptly slow economic growth.
Right. It's interesting. We're, you know, if you're an investor in the United States and you're used to investing domestically, you're investing in an economy that controls the world's reserve currency.
Yes.
When you invest in a variety of emerging markets, you're investing in economies that are at the mercy of the world or world, you know, the larger currencies.
Yep.
It's a very different competitive position.
Yep. Another thing is capital market inflation. So, you know, you have risks of excessive capital flows chasing a limited supply of financial assets. And,
right.
you know, this is the old too much money chasing too few goods or services. And that can create or has created in the past bubbles.
Right.
And if not bubbles, it can create massive declines very quickly.
Right.
Another thing is institutional risk, and you kind of touched on this. You know, in the emerging market, the accounting rules, again, we have rules, whether they follow them is another thing, but, you know, they don't have necessarily the rules, standards, and the regulatory framework that we've seen mostly in the advanced developed economies.
You do not have within the culture, within the people, the managerial infrastructure that you do in the developed world.
Absolutely.
You just don't have it.
Absolutely, and that's, you know, that's another risk that one takes while investing there. And, of course, liquidity. You know, this is a real sensitive subject to me, but the emerging markets typically have a much lighter trading volumes and a smaller number of participants than you do have in the developed market. So this creates a risk that investors wishing to sell will not be able to find somebody to buy their shares at a specific price, right?
Right, so, and this one is very hard for me because most of the companies that I really find to be, you know, just excellent management, excellent product and services, they're not liquid.
Right.
They're not liquid.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, the question is, you know, it's great. You can say, well, I'll buy it and I'll just hang on to it forever. But, you know, good luck trying to get rid of it if you need to. And there's two more here, and one of them, you know, I had to do some research on this case came up. It's something called a middle income trap, and I didn't know what this was. This is really, you know, historically it's shown that almost all high growth countries that are transitioning from lower income to middle income have experienced a major growth slowdown as their economies have gotten larger and more complex and their living standards have risen.
Right.
And it's really interesting. There hasn't been...
They plateau,
and it's like they have to consolidate. It's like a stock going up.
Right.
It has to consolidate before it makes its next move up. And then finally, I'm going to leave this to you because this is, you know, this is your bailiwick, but, you know, the political risks that are associated with the emerging markets.
Right. And one of the things we've seen, you know, I think there have been a lot of political risks in the emerging markets since 2008, 2010, just because I see the developed world during it, you know, as Europe is working out and now as we have a budget issues, you see the developed world calling capital home. Mm-hmm. If you look at the politics of the G20, you know, the G12 or 13 have been sort of flexing their muscles, and G7 has been saying, you know, what G7 giveth, G7 taketh away. You know, so you've seen a real tug of war going on, and it's part of the consolidation of a new sort of rebalancing of the global economy. So power swings to the emerging markets, and then G7 asserts its authority and it swings. So right now we're in a situation where it's swinging back. And to me, you know, it's just part of the pendulum swinging back and forth as we rebalance. So I don't think it's permanent, but we're definitely, and we have G7 saying they're going to target the tax havens. So, you know, that's a lot of capital, and that capital can swing the world in lots of funny directions.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I think it's in chart number 10 or 9, whatever, a couple ahead of us here. That'll just reiterate or reemphasize
right.
You know, the point you just made in terms of it quantifies it. It's amazing what has happened because of this.
It's amazing.
So,
well, don't count G7 out.
No.
So we used to say on Wall Street, looking at that chart, wow, that's real power.
So, you know, this is the risk. So what we've done is we've, you know, I've kind of put together a list of some pros, and then we talked about the cons. So now we have a framework for risk and reward. Let's take a look at where we are today.
Okay.
Real briefly. So, you know, since the stock market, U.S. stock market, bottomed in 2009, an investment in the collective emerging markets has gone nowhere. It's flat. While the S&P has doubled.
Right.
So here we are, United States stock market has doubled. Is that because we have such a far undervaluation in 2009 that the S&P was so far undervalued that it had to revert back to the mean? Or is this because of what you said, political risks and flexing muscles?
Well, but there are two issues. One is after, you know, after we sort of came out of the lows in 2008, 2009, the two were tracking together.
Yes.
The emerging markets,
yes,
and U.S. or North American equities and developed world were tracking up. And it's really just been at the beginning of this year, well, 2012, we've just seen a huge split.
Yes.
And part of my question, I think part of it is G7 calling the capital home. But the other question is, how dependent are the emerging markets on the commodities markets? Because we've seen commodities,
yes,
as commodities have fallen, the emerging markets have gotten slaughtered. And part of it is Europe's not buying, so China doesn't make, so they don't buy from Brazil. And that part of that is sort of this big question over what we call the commodity super cycle.
And one of the things I throw out there for thought is that when you have an outperformance, a consistent outperformance in a sector or a region or something, and it's clearly identifiable, what you have is you start to see the herd start to move towards that and ignore the things that are of value. And I was going to talk about that
right.
a little bit later.
But okay.
So part of that is, you know, in my mind, I think it's, you know, it's a whole conglomeration of all of these things. But part of it is because of the fact that we see when the, you know, if you're looking at where to invest your money, you've got money to do right away. Do you want to, you look at, most people look behind them and see what has performed best
right.
over the last period of time. And the developed world, the United States, has just done unbelievably in comparison. So that's where the money tends to flow.
Right.
But that too is a pendulum, and it may swing at some point in time too. Well, we know it'll swing.
We were hoping you would tell us exactly when to.
Oh, of course. I can predict that. So one of the things I just wanted to say is So the United States stock market has doubled. Let's take a look at why either the emerging markets haven't done as well.
Okay.
Okay. So the first reason is growth. And so, you know, this was the whole discussion and value that the emerging markets bring. But so while the backdrop of the long term is very positive, you know, with the developed world attempting to rebuild their collective balance sheets and them no longer providing this endless demand of emerging market exports, right?
Right.
And so the days also of China's double-digit GDP growth are gone.
Right.
You know, now, not that 7% is anything to sneeze at, but, you know, they were 10, 12, 13%. Now they're at 7%. Now, is that going to reassert itself? It's going to be hard.
Right.
Additionally, what you tend to see is that the emerging markets as a whole were really dependent upon the Chinese growth engine. And so that, you know, that's that was the emerging market as a whole has been driven, or their poor performance has been driven because of China. But also, if you look at India, their growth is halved.
Mm-hmm.
And even worse, Brazil has only grown up 1%.
Right.
So another reason is, in my mind, is that liquidity. So what happened was is that as the United States interest rates continued to fall, what you saw is that, you know, to counter the first dot-com slump and then the financial crisis of 2008, what that did was it fueled the carry trade,
right,
for investors. And so what that means is that they're borrowing cheap U.S. dollars and going in and chasing higher yields, whether they be yields in emerging market debt or in equities. And what has happened is that now with interest rates starting to rise, that whole argument
for the flow of the
carry trade is going, you know, if it's reversing, it's changing direction.
Right.
And one other reason, I think, is, you know, unfortunately, they seem to be a victim of their own success. So they have, you know, their governments are trying to walk this fine tightrope. On one hand, they're trying to contain the inflation.
Right.
Right. And on the other hand, they're trying to keep growth at a satisfactory pace.
Right.
And so as such, you know, most of the emerging market companies have also missed their analyst profit expectations for the last five quarters. And also what we can see is that the expansion of the economies in China and Brazil have been slowed to their weakest point since 2009.
Right.
So you have just this trend that was very, very positive has really slowed down.
So if you're the president of Brazil, you're having a very bad year because there's no growth and everybody, all your citizens are mad. And meantime, the president is listening. The president of the United States is listening to your phone calls and you're just having a really bad year.
Right. If you're in Brazil, the other thing that would really bother you is that you didn't do so well in the World Cup.
Right.
Okay. And then finally, you know, the fourth reason, you know, I think why they're kind of languishing a bit is that, you know, the investors, and this is what I talked about before, investors as a whole are really appearing to be more cautious since the 2008-2009 crisis. So the risk premium for the emerging markets investments has increased, and as such, that money is actually sticking closer to home. You know why? It's easier to monitor, it's more transparent, and quite frankly, investors seem to be turning a blind eye to that proven successful investment strategy of diversification. And instead, what they're doing is concentrating on what's hot.
Well, to me, the question then is where is the opportunity? Because when I look at the quality of investments and management teams in some of the emerging markets, you know, I'm very impressed. So if you look, can I turn to your chart 9?
Sure.
So if you look at your chart 9, if I can find a great management team and a good company with strong markets, and it's basically trading at a PE, if you look at the averages of 14, when I've got to pay 24 for that same amount of income,
yep.
You know, so I can basically buy a dollar of income for $14 that, in my mind, is just as good as, you know, paying 24
right
in the North American market. Why would I do that?
Right, exactly. And while there are those risks of currencies that you don't have to worry about in the United States market, you know, I look at this as very akin to what happened. It's not quite as bad, but the valuations are compelling in the emerging markets such
right.
that the is similar to what happened in the United States in 2009 at the bottom.
Right.
So, you know, at some point in time, and it may have already started, at some point in time, the there's going to be some accumulation of the smart money is going to be moving back into that market
right.
because the overvaluation in the United States stock.
Now, but here's the thing, and I should say in the last quarter they've moved up a little bit. So, you know, maybe it's turned. But if you look at, again, at what G7's talking about doing in terms of the tax havens, and if you look at the politics going on now between the G20 and the G7, mm-hmm. it says to me, you know, the war's not over.
No. And the other thing that's driving this is the dollar.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so we're right at a line of, you know, we've drawn a line in the sand right where we're at today. And I think that, you know, what the emerging markets do is going to also be driven by what the dollar does.
Right.
And as such, if the dollar falls, you would expect commodities to get back in vogue and therefore the emerging markets to be much more attractive.
Right. And that's going to hammer U.S.
Yes.
U.S. equities. You
yes,
know, I've got to the point where I think of this all around Starbucks. You know, if the price of coffee goes up and the cost of borrowing money goes up, Starbucks earnings goes down. It's all very simple.
Well, you know, I mean, if you, that chart that you brought up, chart number 9, you know, to me, that's a value investor's dream.
Right.
And so, but the problem is you've got this conundrum that we've got.
You've got this war going on.
Exactly.
Right.
And, you know, that leads me to chart number 10, my final chart. So what you're looking at is this is the flow of money year to date. On the far right-hand column, it says YTD, the flow of money year-to-date into equities, global equities.
Right.
Okay, and what you see is that on average, or not on average, in total, there was $160 billion year-to-date that flowed into global equities. Now, that sounds good, but what you also see, which is not so good, is that all of that flowed into the developed market. In addition, more flowed into the developed market as it pulled $8 billion out of the emerging markets.
So it's net pull from the emerging markets.
Net pull from the emerging markets into the developed markets. So, you know, my feeling is until that changes, you need to minimize your exposure to the emerging markets because, you know, money flowing into a place or a thing is what's going to drive prices higher.
Right.
So I kind of feel that, you know, there's no real compelling reason right now yet
right.
to be first to the party into the emerging markets.
Right, but it's certainly something to be
Absolutely.
To watch very closely.
Absolutely.
The other thing I will say is when you focus on great companies and finding great opportunities in great companies, you just never know.
Right.
You know, you and I can sit here and say, we want nothing to do with this market,
right.
and the next day we find a great company.
Absolutely. No, absolutely, and we've done that.
Yes, we have.
So just to wrap this up, you know, I think, you know, in the end and over the long haul, investing is, for me, it's finding about those growth areas, and it's finding those growth prospects, and the growth prospects of the emerging markets going forward is very compelling. But as with any growth prospect, there's always a myriad of risk and one must contend with. So the one thing I feel comfortable saying, though, is that no matter how much the emerging market grow, whether that's up or down, and you can call it a lot, you know, it could not grow, I believe that there's a very high probability that regardless of what that is, it's going to be significantly in excess of the developed market.
Right.
Right? So as such, you know, for those investors that are willing to assume the risks, they understand them, they have a long-term time horizon, and they're willing to live with the inherent volatility. You know, the potential reward suggests that you really do need to have a portion of your investments, you know, focused on the emerging markets.
Right. Right. I remember reading one investment advisor who advised basically you should look at the global GNP.
Yes.
And you should allocate your portfolio according to the global GNP, which would be very difficult because if it's 80% of the of the GNP, but only 12% of the equity flow, that's going to be tough to do. The one thing I wanted to mention was, or to bring up, is that when you start to look at investing in the emerging markets, you're really, in most cases, forced into mutual funds or ETFs or certain kinds of vehicles because oftentimes these markets don't have a lot of liquidity.
Correct.
If you limit yourself to the ADRs, which are the ones traded on the U.S. markets, you know, you're going to miss a lot of the great opportunities. And also, frankly, in some of these markets, you just want somebody whose life is
right.
totally expert at that place, because it takes a lot of very specialized knowledge to watch. So oftentimes, I think, particularly for retail investors, you want to come in on the, you know, following somebody who's really focused on that market.
Absolutely. And you've said it, you know, ever since I've known you, boots on the ground makes a huge difference to understanding what you're investing in, where you're investing in. And, you know, as much as we would love to be able to say that we're experts on understanding the emerging markets, I can't say that I have any edge over somebody that's actually sitting there and immersed in it day to day.
It was really funny. I was my first year at Dillon Reed. I came back from they used to send the first year associates off to the annual meetings. So I went to the annual meeting of Colgate Palmolive, who was a big client, and the whole board was like 70 years old, and they were all men. And I came back, they showed the products and the video, and it was all women buying stuff. And I came back, and they said, "What do you think?" And I said, "You know, until they put Irma Bombeck on the board, sell Colgate." And sure enough, the stock died. And that was my first lesson is, you know, you really want to go kick the – I used to – you know, when you could still get in, I'd go right up and down in the elevators and talk to people and, you know, do all sorts of things to get inside and see what the companies were like. But I think you really have to – you know, I think you really have to be there. So, okay, well, Chuck, any other summary thoughts you want to –
No, I the one thing I didn't touch on, and you know what we did is I think we did a reasonable job of framing the pros and the cons. And what I don't want anybody to walk away from here is that, as with any investment in emerging markets, is one, you need to also be very, very aware and concerned with the point at which you enter. So I'm not saying to anybody this is a time to go enter the emerging markets, even though the argument for the valuations is very, very compelling.
Right. You need to watch the PEs.
You need to watch the PEs. You also those PEs can become a lot lower than what they are today. You can see a PE instead of 12, you can see it down at 10. And here you are, if you bought in today, I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but I'm saying as long as the trend follow the money, that's really the key. The problem is it's really hard to find that data. And when you do find it, it's typically a year or so later.
Right. Although I have to say, I think the charts in this presentation are very helpful. And from them, you can start to think about how you want to follow the analytics.
Absolutely.
The other thing I do want to say is I find looking and studying the emerging markets to be one of the most hopeful things I do. And, you know, this is maybe tangential to what investors are interested in, but every day, you know, day after day, you look at these really amazing teams of people who are doing the most, you know, things I would never have thought of. We're in a very mature economy.
Yes.
And when you study what really dynamic management teams are doing in, you know, things you would never have thought of. So one of the things I keep mentioning to everybody is, you know, Jack Ma started Alibaba in 1999. Oh, yeah. It was worth zero. Today, they're talking about doing the IPO at $70 billion. That's a pretty dynamic company.
Yes.
So you see these amazing things going on, and it reminds you, you know, that the world is full of opportunities.
Yes.
So it's one of the things I love, because I will say these markets are a little bit wild for me sometimes, but they're very, very interesting.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that enthusiasm comes across greatly, and I find that very very helpful for me, because I'm not as optimistic as you are. I tend to see things more negatively, and
uh-huh.
you know, you keep mentioning, you know, if there's 7 billion people waking up every morning, moving and you know, going to work and doing hustling and bustling, you know, we're all concerned about collapse of the dollar or this happening or that happening. You know what? It's going to be hard to change the flow of 7 billion people all at once.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, that's it for this quarter. I can't wait to hear what you're going to have for us next quarter.
Well, thank you. It was great being with you, and we'll talk again.
Okay. Bye.